You're tuned to WVBR FM Ithaca.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
Welcome to tonight's show. I am your host, Soraya, and we have some very cool stuff coming up for you tonight. First of all, with Micah Hanks, we are going to be having a discussion that starts out a touch political. We're going to talk about Syria a little bit, and then we're going to get into the idea of conspiracies and why people believe or don't believe in conspiracies, and eventually we're going to branch off into some very deep talk about the paranormal. And this was recorded last Thursday, a couple days ago. And unfortunately, we were not able to do this live tonight. But we have some very special stuff coming up for you in the upcoming weeks. Next week, I will have on, hopefully, Nick Redfern, who I've been trying to get on since the beginning of the show. His new book, Monster Files, is absolutely fascinating. And we're going to be talking to him about that, as well as a lot of his other work. He is one of the most prolific writers on the paranormal. And that'll be next week. The week after that, we're going to have our very first in-studio guest, that being a man named Peter Robbins. And Peter is a very well-known, very well-read ufologist. And so he's going to be joining us in studio that night, which should be fantastic. The week after that, I'm going to have on David Politis. And we've been talking about David Politis' work for quite a while. That'll be September 21st, and we're probably going to do a two-hour show for that. We're going to be discussing his missing 411 work, and it's going to be a very fascinating discussion. If you've been following the show, you've heard me talk, among other guests, about some of the work he's been doing. So, that's upcoming in October. On October 12th, Aleister Crowley's birthday, we're going to have Joseph Thebus back to discuss some more about Aleister Crowley. And if you're listening to this, do me a favor. Go like our Facebook page. Go follow us on Twitter. Go leave us a rating on, or not a rating, or a rating and a review on iTunes. We'd really appreciate it. Of course, you can always find us on YouTube, Vimeo. You can download podcasts right from the website. You can subscribe on iTunes. And whenever we're doing a live show, you're welcome to come into the chat room and propose questions, which I will pass on to the guests. Tonight's show, as I said, is pre-recorded, so that's not going to work tonight. But in the future, which most of the shows here are live, the only time they are not is when it is impossible for one reason or another. Also upcoming, I might be doing some podcast-only shows that will just be available on the website. I'm working out whether I want to do that or not, but I'm leaning more and more toward that being the case, in which case there will be occasionally a second show during the week. All right. With that being said, it is time for a fascinating and deep discussion with Micah Hanks, author of a few books, including the UFO Singularity and host of the Graylian Report and the Micah Hanks Program. How you doing, Micah?
Syria, I'm doing great. It's good to be back on your show. Good to be able to have an opportunity to talk with you and not be running 50 miles a minute, like I typically am.
And that's Soraya.
Soraya, I know. I always do that. I think I did that last time, too. Always. Uh-huh. Yeah. It's kind of like Mika versus Micah. Soraya, yeah. I'll remember it one day.
So you've picked up a second radio show since the last time we talked, I believe.
I have, yeah. It's a show called the Micah Hanks. No, I'm kidding. No, watch, I'll do it to myself now. It's the Micah Hanks Program on KGRARadio.com, and it broadcasts in the same time slot as Graylian Report, just on a different night of the week. If people listen live to Graylian, it's Tuesday at 8 p.m. This show is Sunday nights at 8 p.m., 2 hours, and it's immediately before my good friends Scotty Roberts and John Ward's program, which is Intrepid Radio. So really, people tune in on Sunday nights. You can tune in and listen live for free, and there's 4 hours, literally, two shows back to back that explore the esoteric and the unusual. So it's kind of cool.
And how does it differ from the Grailian Report? The Grailian Report, you seem to have a little bit of fun with news stories and stuff for the first hour, and then usually a guest.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Soraya, I've never really wanted to be one of those guys that has to rely entirely on having a guest on the show. But yet, I think that by the same token, I can't always do this, but if I'm available, my guests are in town, you know, I live in Asheville, North Carolina, and every now and then I do have some of my guests, or not guests, but my listeners, they'll come through town and they'll be like, you know, Mike, is there any way we can catch up? And as a matter of fact, I feel bad. I think I missed a gentleman just the other day, just couldn't fit him in. But, you know, when I do have time to sit down with people, I love to interact with listeners and find out what they like. And a lot of people have said two things. We love conspiracies and we love the guests that you pick to have on the program. And I do try to pick different kinds of guests. And so if I can't just sit there and ramble all the time, and I have to have guests on from time to time just for the benefit of my listeners, and also for the benefit of me, because truly, over the years, I've gotten more and more to a point of enjoying just being able to sit down and talk with somebody, you know, and you learn so much when you have knowledgeable guests on. And so for me, that's something I've come to look forward to every week. And yeah, with the Grailian Report, we tend to look at news and then, you know, I'll have different guests and people. This week, I literally did almost 2 hours with Dr. John Ward.
Which was excellent.
Yeah, he's just an interesting person. I mean, you know, he studies everything from the occult to, you know, mysticism and, of course, ancient Egyptian studies. He's in Silsila right now with his lovely maiden there, Miss Maria Nilsson. And the two of them, of course, she also, you know, an expert. Actually, I tell you the truth, an academic expert in Egyptian and ancient cultures, but the two of them are in Silsila right now, and so that's what he does. And of course, also he's co-authored a book with Scotty Roberts called The Exodus Reality, but his knowledge base is so broad. You know, that first hour we primarily talked about the situation in Syria, and
yeah,
I'm so concerned about that. Now, the Micah Hanks program focuses a little more on that kind of subject. You know, I talk more about current issues, current events. You know, again, I wanted to be able to say, hey, we do one show on the paranormal. Let's not do Grailian Report twice a week. I'm going to branch out a little with this one. We'll talk about, you know, a lot more about conspiracies and a lot more about current events. We'll talk about things like UFOs from time to time, but then we'll also talk about mind control. We'll talk about, you know, the Federal Reserve. We'll talk about, you know, the geoeconomic crisis. We talk about all different kinds of things on the Micah Hanks program. And every now and then, you'll see a little bleed back and forth, especially when there's something really timely like this, the Syria thing. And, you know, I think it's got a lot of us concerned right now.
Yeah, those people who don't pay attention to mainstream news, at least, are concerned.
Well, yes, exactly. You know, that's the thing, you know. And I like with these programs, as you do as well, Soraya, you know, I like to be able to offer an alternative to what people are seeing on the mainstream, you know. Although what's interesting, and I'm liking this more and more, is that I'm even seeing some of the mainstream news sources, especially with regard to the Syria issue. Here, the UN goes in. They're not even on the ground. There are snipers that are already shooting at them as they're trying to get to the site of the alleged chemical weapons attack. The Obama administration saying, yeah, we're going in there and we're going to have to, you know, take action. And of course, I understand exactly why they've said that they're going to do this, because with the Chemical Weapons Convention, there is a precedent that we want to do everything we can to deter the use of chemical weapons around the world. Now, the way it gets into the conspiracy element, however, is that there are literally some mainstream news sources that are talking about, well, the UN investigators are saying that they aren't certain that it was actually the Syrian government, the Assad, that launched this chemical weapons attack. Now, again, you know, in the Americas right now, we're hearing that there are inside sources, both U.S. and Israeli sources that are unnamed, who have said, yes, we have compelling evidence that this was the Assad that was behind this. UN investigators that are out there on the ground, man, they're already saying there's very, very, very strong evidence, not conclusive proof, but strong evidence that supports the idea that the rebels, in other words, Al-Qaeda, have been involved in this. And so right now, we haven't even determined who launched the attack, and we're talking about launching, you know, again, U.S. intervention against the Assad regime, which, again, that would essentially be supporting Al-Qaeda, the very people who were behind, you know, if you don't follow conspiracy theories, of course, the 9/11 attacks, which I think that was a mixed bag, too. It's just, it's so complex. And so, yes, yeah, you have to acknowledge two things, that there are conspiratorial elements to some of this, but that they aren't completely woo, and they may not all have to do with New World Order, you know, but that we also have to look at these things and we have to understand these things so that we're as humans on the same page. And that's why on my shows I choose to talk about those kind of things, and in a way that you probably won't hear about in a more mainstream source.
Well, I think that what we're seeing with Syria is not all that different from the lead up to the Iraq war, but exactly. The consequences might be a lot more severe.
Exactly. And maybe that's the most important thing that anyone could say is, look, guys, we can look back. We made this mistake once, but this time, Syria is not going to be, you know, again, right now, the issues with Syria, and then, of course, what John Ward referred to as, you know, the thermometer of the region, which is Turkey, he calls it, the thermometer by which, you know, we will be able to gauge what's going to be happening throughout the region. Our involvement with Syria, this could be a game changer. People are saying, and they always will, but people are saying World War III, people are saying all different kinds of things. The big issue here is, again, the alliances that involve Russia, China, and countries like this, Iran, and you know, if the United States, backed by Britain, backed by Israel, and different countries are involving themselves in this, with the tensions that are already growing, especially between the United States and Russia, in wake of the Snowden affair, this could get dirty. This really could get dirty, and we need to be vigilant about it. And again, I think it's important to talk about this. But yeah, you hit the nail on the head. Not only does this mirror what we saw prior to going into Iraq, where you believe that there were WMDs, we got there were none that we could find. If we make that same mistake with Syria, there could be much graver consequences that are longer reaching too.
Well, that, and you know, it never escapes my mind that these are all the countries that were on the list that the Project for the New American Century wanted to take over.
Yes, of course. And those things have to be taken into consideration just as well. Again, you know, I've got friends who have pointed out to me recently, you know, Mike, there was a game plan. There are aspects of this that are planned. You won't hear mainstream news sources talking about that. You know, what you did hear them talking about was, what was it, just last week, you know, the CIA's acknowledgement of their involvement with the 1954 Iranian coup, where essentially they worked with, the CIA rather was tapped to work with British Petroleum and the British government to overthrow the government of Mohammad Mossadegh. And when this ended up happening, you know, people look at this, and I think a lot of people say, okay, well, that was then, and maybe there's justification, for, you know, U.S. Agencies and the like being involved in international affairs if it protects the home front. But I'm thinking, you know, what protects the home front, you know, or what is protecting the home front when we're going in there like we did in 1954 and helping basically protect the oil interests in this region? We overthrow a democratic leader, Mohammad Mossadegh. The Shah is put in power. Where did that get us a few decades on down the road? You know?
Yeah. Well, you know, and that's also one of those things, like when they made that announcement, it's like, oh, we didn't already know that?
Yeah, come on. Yeah, exactly. Just like we didn't know Area 51 existed, right?
Yeah. Or the whole NSA, you know, the NSA is spying on everyone, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, this was a revelation. I see.
Before that revelation, before any of that stuff came out, Soraya, earlier this year I was talking with a friend of mine, and he is an artist and an event promoter and everything, and he had incidentally also worked as a software designer for a number of years, and so, you know, he had designed some software, not surveillance software or anything like that, but he had worked in designing some software, you know, that had been utilized by different agencies and things, and so he had a lot of friends who were, you know, involved with intelligence and things like that, but he had pointed out to me, and we were sitting there talking on Skype one day, he says, oh man, the NSA, they've got the ability to monitor all this stuff. They can listen to everything. They can record. They record everything. They're listening to Skype calls to record them all. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh, okay, sure, whatever. You know, again, somebody who I consider myself to be fairly open-minded, but I'm listening to this fella saying all this, and I'm thinking, well, maybe I hesitate to go so far as to believe that everybody's being watched and every communication is being recorded, everything's being tapped. What was it, 6 months later, this bombshell breaks open. This former Fed agent, Ted Clemente, comes out and literally says, you know, in response to the discussion about the Tsarnaev brothers and Tamerlan and Dzhokhar Tsarnaev and their involvement with the Boston Marathon bombing, this guy is saying, no, I guarantee you every conversation Tamerlan Tsarnaev had with his wife or anybody else, we have access to those. And so what's interesting is that a lot of people, including Alex Jones, and, you know, I don't mean to sound like, I want to say one thing and get this clear with everybody. I don't agree with everything that Alex Jones says. I do admire Alex Jones. I think some of the things that he says are pretty far out, but time and time again, I have also found that maybe what I differ with Alex on the most is just his presentation of the information. But in truth, if you actually look at what he says, I have found time and time again that Alex says a lot of he puts a lot of information out there that is backed up by official data. And I think that the way that he presents it causes a lot of people to think he's crazy, but really the majority of what he says is rooted in fact, and if not all of it. And he's an incredibly intelligent person, someone that I truly admire in that sense. I do impressions and I act like a clown sometimes on my programs, and a lot of people think they misinterpret that as me disliking Alex Jones, and that's not the case at all. In fact, I listen to his program from time to time and I find him very interesting. But I bring him up because, again, right after the Boston Marathon bombing, here's Alex Jones saying, this reeks of a false flag. Now, I didn't agree with that statement, and the only reason I didn't is because I felt like Alex was saying that just a little too soon after it happened. And just because there is historical precedent for false flag operations, even carried out by the U.S. government, that alone, okay, we can't look back at, we can't look back at Operation Northwoods or something like that and say that, okay, here's proof that something could have happened potentially in the past, and therefore it's likely that it's occurring today. I don't think that that's a strong enough argument to be made without direct evidence to support the operation that is being asserted in the modern sense. In other words, okay, where's the direct evidence that supports that there was an inside job going on behind the scenes with the Boston Marathon bombing? But what's interesting is that is still, I think, going to remain in American history a turning point, that actual terrorist attack. And the reason why is because it may not have been on a large scale, quite the likes of 9/11 or Oklahoma City, or anything like that, or depending on which kind of terrorism you're talking about. Some might even say, the Branch Davidians down there in Waco, Texas, back in the, the early 90s. But the other thing, too, is that the Boston Marathon bombing, I think it's going to be remembered because rather than being a significant act of terror, it was the straw that broke the camel's back. And as a result of the investigation into the Tsarnaev brothers, look what we got. Look at how that is where a lot of this information started coming out. And people started acknowledging in public forums, actually, we do have the ability to access telephone records and data and things like this. What do you mean? What are you getting at, Ted Clemente? That everybody's being listened to? That everything's being recorded? Oh, yeah. And you follow the paper trail. Wired magazine carried a Project Raptor? They carried a front page story about this facility out there in like Utah, wherever it is, that is literally utilizing incredibly massive databases for purposes of recording and collecting data. So, if we look over the last year, both in mainstream sources, actually primarily in mainstream sources, Fox News and MSNBC conversations, with people who are intelligence officials and things in relation to the Boston Marathon bombing and the collection of data, the biggest thing about that and why I think it'll be historically significant is that we're going to look back at this and realize that this was the point at which it all became public knowledge, just how vast our surveillance programs were and how much people were actually being watched and how much information was actually being gathered, which is essentially everything about everybody.
This works well because I wanted to talk to you about conspiracies in general.
Yeah.
that's a good place to start. When it comes to people like Alex Jones, though, too, you figure that he needs ratings. He needs people to keep listening, and I think sometimes he will take solid information and maybe skew it toward a more fearsome interpretation.
I agree. Yeah.
It's not so much that he's wrong, but he's putting it out there in a way that isn't made to make people angry or scare people. And someone like Rush Limbaugh does the same thing. He'll take information and skew it to make people angry, to support his agenda,
mm-hmm.
and to keep his ratings up.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we see everyone do that. And it's funny because every now and then I'll get a wild hair up my backside and I'll decide that I'm going to go out there and I'm going to write some sort of a really just, not sensational. I try not to ever be really sensational, but I might become a little bit more aggressively verbose, we would say, in the way that I will word things in an argument. I wrote an article for Mysterious Universe recently. Been writing for Mysterious Universe going on 4 years, 4 or 5 years. Gosh, it's been a while now. And, love those guys, Ben and Aaron. And, of course, as a staff writer for Mysterious Universe, I try to be the guy that focuses less on the paranormal. We've got a bunch of great writers, including my buddy Nick Redfern, who are writing for us now. And so, with Mysterious Universe, there's so much paranormal stuff. I'm kind of the guy who writes about, esoteric and mysticism and conspiracies and current events. I try to be the person who offers a little bit of that alternative in that format. But all that to say, I wrote this article recently and talked a little bit about you know, which of these quote-unquote sycophants, you know, which of these little narcissistic blogger types is going to come after me and try and insinuate that I said this or this when really, in fact, I'm saying this, so let me be clear and declarative about it. But, you know, but aside from my weak moments, I guess, where I get out there and I just want to go after somebody, and I think all of us do, and it's sadly, Soraya, I think it's expected of us as writers, bloggers, journalists, and whatnot today. But I also look back to writers like Jacques Vallée, people who have written about strange, you know, and honestly, I think at times also very conspiratorial subjects. If you don't consider UFOs a conspiratorial subject, I recommend that people read the book that Jacques Vallée wrote back in the mid-90s called Revelations, Alien Contact and Human Deception, where he gets into everything from, I think, the LaRouche Society, you know, the LaRouche Pack, and the Raelian cult, maybe even the Church of Scientology, and their apparent connection with an ongoing UFO misinformation campaign. It does sound like it's just absurdity, but when you actually see the way that he very skeptically disseminates this information, you begin to see that, oh, okay, well, there very well could be a conspiratorial element underlying even UFO research. And this is being put forth by a person who is not sensational at all in the way that he writes. Vallée is a very good writer, but he's also a very science-minded, non-sensational writer. And I like to try and be more like that myself.
I think that with the UFO phenomena, after, you know, Roswell and all that, they started to learn how to manipulate this, to cover their test flights, to see how well they could manipulate the public. I think that's part of, you were talking a few weeks ago on the Grelian Report about the MI6 document. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how much that was released just to see how people would respond to it.
I'm convinced that there are tangible, real elements to what we would call the UFO phenomenon. I also believe that probably 95% of everything else that is put forth and called ufology is either comprised by hoaxes, or a lot of it also, maybe a majority of it, is at least those that stem from more official channels, like you know, the MJ-12 documents and things like that. I think that they are obviously misinformation that takes the perception of a, in the minority, what remains a real phenomenon, and it steers that. And it steers that in such a way that it can influence public perception and, yes, conveniently hide the truth about what's going on behind the scenes. And I have no doubt in my mind whatsoever that the majority of the UFO phenomenon, the majority of what we perceive as the UFO phenomenon, probably deals with, you know, and again, we're looking at that minority of things that actually appear to be physical, actual craft, but the minority of these do, I think, stem from Earth and Earthbound technologies that utilize misinformation for purposes of dissuading people from looking at it as being anything terrestrial. But all that to say, you know, coming back around to conspiracies and whatnot, yeah, everybody's got an agenda, whether they're using misinformation to steer people or whether, like Alex Jones does, I think he uses good information, but he presents it in a way that his listenership will find compelling. He, you know, highly sensationalizes it, and I don't think that he would disagree. I mean, anyone who's sitting there and who raises their voice and shouts and gets as emotional as he does, I mean, it's like watching a hellfire and brimstone Baptist minister. You know, I mean, he's very much, you know, he's very passionate about it, and that is very sensational, juxtaposed against someone like Jacques Vallée, who tries to present information in a very methodical, reasonable, but still compelling manner. You know, so I think that when it comes to conspiracies, you know, there's a lot of good information out there, but, you know, people misconstrue it as this or that based often on the way it is presented.
Yeah. It seems like with conspiracies, with a lot of things, with the paranormal and spirituality and stuff like that, you have the extreme believers,
yeah,
who think everything's a conspiracy. And then you have the other side, where people who just don't believe conspiracies happen.
Yeah.
And both those sides tend not to really be anywhere near close to the mark. Because, I mean, we've seen conspiracies in the past. We have evidence they've occurred in the past. And who knows how many have happened that we know nothing about. Whereas it's pretty clear not everything is a conspiracy.
Yeah. You know, Maya... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It seems like there should be a middle ground that that people need to kind of reset and really ask better questions and not accept, you know, not just accept whatever answers fit the paradigm that they're trying to create.
Yes. Well, certainly. you know, at this point, in relation to what you're talking about there, Soraya, I want to refer to an article that was written for the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry. You know, they're considered bad guys by a lot of people who study the unexplained. I mean, I you know, I was the guy who would march into Barnes & Noble and everyone would give me strange looks because I'd be the guy who'd be buying the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, you know. I don't get all my information from one source. When it comes to the unexplained, you're going to find me reading Anomalous.com, DailyGrail.com, and I'll be going over to the skeptical blogs. Now, my friend Sharon Hill wrote an article for the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry website, which, of course, you know, I believe is, I think Skeptical Inquirer is one of their publications. And she wrote an article for their blog titled UFO Research is Up in the Air, Can It Be Scientific? And I will skip to the very end where she states, after going over whether or not, she's not trying to say that ufology is completely bunk. I think she's trying to say, can UFO research actually be scientific? If you've read Jacques Vallée, and actually, again, Sharon, someone who I like to confer with a good bit from time to time, I think we both mutually respect one another, even though I think she rather jokingly said one time, I'm skeptical of your skepticism, because I've told her I'm very skeptical. You know,
she does the Doubtful News website too, right?
She does indeed, yes. And she, you know, again, I recommend to anyone her Media Guide to Skepticism. I even wrote an article about that, mentioned that, and talked a good bit about it, that for Mysterious Universe. And, you know, she and I, we stay in touch quite a bit. You know, I think that, but the thing that's good about Sharon too is a lot of people paint her with the same brush that Philip J. Klass and people like that have been painted with. You know, Sharon is a much more, if not an open-minded skeptic, she's a person who is very willing to sit down and listen to what people have to say and not discount anything, while still upholding, I think, the more virtuous aspects of true scientific skepticism. Now, at the end of her article here, she says, quote, "For now, ufology attempts to sound sciencey, but it is not nearly up to the standards to be called science. Can it be science?" And then she goes on to say, "Only with a wholesale change in assumptions and approach," and which mirrors precisely what, you know, you and I've been talking about. You know, yes, we might actually further our knowledge in relation to UFOs and what real aspects of this phenomenon may exist if we change aspects of our approach. I agree with that. And she says here, "Can it be science? Only with a wholesale change in assumptions and approach." I agree 100%. But then the very last line is interesting. She says, and I think this to an extent, even for a skeptical writer, is a little more sensational. She says, "Drop the fascination with conspiracies and abductions. Go back to nuts and bolts." I do agree with that to an extent. But again, one of the most scientific writers on ufology, Jacques Vallée, again, I recommend people read Revelations, where he goes into the actual conspiracy element going on behind the scenes. And he presents some very good data to back up his belief that there are conspiracies. Again, defining a conspiracy as being, you know, two or more individuals working subversively, typically on some operation that comes, you know, to the detriment of another, and that individual whom it affects, often negatively, that person is typically unaware of what is being perpetrated against them. I think very clearly that by that definition, that conspiracies are enacted against UFO researchers carried out by organizations or individuals in secret, and that this actually shows that there is a component behind UFO research that is, again, very man-made, and that is not alien or extraterrestrial at all. I think if more skeptics read Jacques Vallée's research, they would begin to see that Vallée, he was very much at times a skeptic himself, and also that he broadened aspects of what may be going on behind the scenes in a way that even I think a lot of a lot of the very best researchers in the field today continue to ignore. And I don't understand how they can continue to be ignored, aside from the simple fact that, again, there are a lot of stigmas and a lot of interpretations that have been based on, you know, data that may or may not be good, and it may have been disproven, you know, as anything but rubbish or trash years and years ago. People keep coming back around to MJ-12 and saying, God, I really think those documents were real. I think that there are aspects of truth pertaining to some of the MJ-12 documents, and I've had more skeptical UFO researcher friends of mine even say, Michael, don't fall into that trap. Don't start saying things like that. It's all bunk. Don't believe the MJ-12 documents. But again, clearly, I think that there are parts of the story that are true. I just don't think the documents, again, are true. I think that the way that they are able to float untruths so easily is that they do incorporate elements of fact into them, and that's what makes them effective.
Well, yeah, and any lie that's mostly true is much easier than something that's a complete lie to pull over on people.
Exactly. If I tell you If I tell you that I had been having lunch with, you know, career diplomats earlier this week, there were 12 of us. I give the names, I give locations, and then you go fact check all this information, and you find out, God, you know, Micah actually was with these guys at the time he said that there were reporters down there at the National Press Club, and sure enough, they were all down there together, and so we know that they were, you know, Micah had the date, he had the time, the location right. Something strange happens, a giraffe walks by, and I note that, and it sounds absurd, but then that information is included, and sure enough, there were even journalists on hand that got photos. And then I say, and a UFO flew overhead. People are going to listen to that, and they're going to say, you know, that's absolutely outlandish, but the giraffe was there, all the diplomats were there, Micah was actually there having lunch with them, and they were at the press club. And so when you put all this bad information, or this good information out, along with one little element that's either skewed, or it's just bunk altogether, you know, or it's misinterpreted, you know, again, people are more likely to look at that and say, well, if all of these aspects of this are true, God, maybe they did see a UFO. Maybe Micah's right. Maybe an actual flying saucer flew overhead, and all these diplomats having their lunch down there by the press club, they all looked up and they saw this just like Micah Hanks said that they did. When in fact, again, all you have to have is one little shred of untruth in the midst of a bunch of good information, and then people start saying, well, it must be true. Look, it must be true. I think it's that simple.
And you also see that even the term conspiracy has been so vilified by the media, and it immediately, you know, someone will hear a conspiracy and they immediately think crackpot, just the same way that they hear UFO and think, oh, crackpot, without any real information behind that assumption.
Yeah, and I think the reason why primarily is because people who tend to be more blatantly and unquestioningly open-minded, I think, also tend to say, okay, well, you know what? I could buy UFOs. I could buy that. I could believe that. I could buy Bigfoot. I could believe Bigfoot. I could buy Loch Ness Monster. I could believe that. And therefore, you tend to find that people who are in these kind of circles of thought where they're so open-minded that in a lot of instances, I think it's also kind of a culture war. They gravitate toward belief because they get angry about the attacks from the people who are disbelievers, and so they tend to believe more and more the more they are attacked. A person like this typically also will hear what may be a very legitimate conspiracy theory and say, oh, come on, obviously. You know, we all know that. We all know that we've been spied on. And so again, we start finding that people who are believers in fringe thoughts and things like this also tend to gravitate toward those quote-unquote conspiracy theories. The difference is that while I think there's plenty of precedent for actual conspiracies, not even just precedent, but actual proof, actual evidence of conspiracies, a conspiracy theory is the assertion based on speculation, even if it's reasoned speculation, that a conspiracy may occur. Now, on my program a couple of weeks ago, I started talking about, you know, when in the future robotic drones are miniaturized to the point that literally we were talking about pollination, you know, with I think colony collapse syndrome and things like that, and we've got issues with where are the bees going.
Right.
Some researchers are literally hoping to be able to utilize miniaturized autonomous drone technologies to create little robots, little literal drones that can fly around and that can pollinate our crops for us in the event that we lose in incredible detrimental numbers our honeybees and other bees and insects that pollinate our crops. So, and I said, now, a bee is equipped with a stinger. Some people can be killed by a honeybee sting. If the technology existed that we could create autonomous little drones that fly around, you know, if we're mimicking nature and we create little drones that are going to behave like bees, how difficult would it be for militaristic purposes, you know, to create a bee type, you know, mechanical device, a drone, equip it with a stinger, equip that stinger with, you know, a poison, and utilize these for purposes of assassination and things like that. Obviously, the trace of the poison would be found, but very easily people could be assassinated for political reasons utilizing that kind of technology. And I said, you know, again, that's speculation. And I pointed out and I said to people on my program, I said to the listeners, this is speculation. I am speculating. But how far off is that from being a possibility? So, again, that is a conspiracy theory in the sense that this is something that could be done. But I think that for people who want to say that all conspiracy theories are bunk, they also need to look at the difference between the theory and then the actual conspiracy. Few who actually study history would be able to make a case against the existence of conspiracies. And yet, I've had if you want to call them colleagues, you know, in the more skeptical circles, who, when I talk about MKUltra, when I talk about, you know, the CIA's involvement in COINTELPRO, they try and debunk those kinds of things. I've even had, I'll tell you who it was. It was Robert Schaefer, you know, again, a skeptic who I respect a lot. And when we met at the UFO Congress back in February, we talked for a long time and exchanged cards and everything. But he told me, my feeling is that UFOs are all bunk. People just lie and know there are not government technologies behind any of these, because if that was the case, that information would be released to the public. And I'm thinking, I just don't agree that everything is released to the public. I don't, you know, and frankly, I think that's kind of a naive statement.
Yeah, and to say that everyone's lying is a weird assumption to make. That many people are going to make up the same story that you know, it would be different for the people who are trying to make a buck off of it, but so many people do it anonymously.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I've seen people, maybe I think there are people who are honest too, who are trying to make, you know, a living off of what they do.
Oh, sure.
But, you know, I also find that, you know, again, sometimes the strain on the credible that is imposed by the skeptical denialist, again, you know, Robert Schaefer, he may be right about a lot of things, and I think he's called the bluff on a lot of aspects of ufology over the years, that, you know, we needed a good skeptical researcher who would say, okay, you know, maybe there's something going on here that we need to look at a little bit more carefully. But then again, you know, to say, you know, no, I don't think these things are government craft, because when I brought that up talking with him, he says, you believe that? And I said, well, I mean, obviously, because I don't think all these things are alien. And I said, what do you think? And he says, no, I think people just make things up. I joked with him. We had a laugh about this. I said, well, then we should do a blog together and call it The Lying Saucer. And he goes, ha, no, we'd be sued. You know, so I mean, it was a friendly conversation we were having. We weren't debating. We weren't fighting. You know, we were in agreement on a lot of things. But I do disagree with him on the fact that most UFO witnesses are just lying, and that the government would not hide information about secret projects from the public. And again, coming back to the conspiracy angle on this, we can theorize about certain conspiracies, and the skeptics can say, but because you have no evidence to support your theory, that is bunk. There are real conspiracies too. And what I really am troubled by is when I see a more skeptical researcher looking at an actual conspiracy and trying to diminish the importance of the conspiracy by taking a skeptical attitude that picks it apart and then tries to assert that there may be less to the story than what historical data even would tell us. Some of them come close to this. And again, I cited in an article at Mysterious Universe some correct assumptions that the skeptic Brian Dunning, who does the Skeptoid podcast, had made about MKUltra. What he said was that because we know that MKUltra and the atrocious things that MKUltra CIA mind control attempts at technologies entailed, because we know that that existed, that does not mean that we can prove that it continues to this day. Now, maybe it does. But Brian was correct in asserting that a lot of people swear that there is still mind control ongoing today, and that MKUltra is proof of that. Now, he's right to point that out and to say maybe we should rein in on our conspiracy theorizing about what's still going on today based solely on what the CIA may have done decades ago. And in fact, he acknowledges they did do. What's interesting, however, is that I've found that, again, not to, you know, mischaracterize what Dunning said, I think he was right, but I've found other skeptics who have read his article will come to me and say, see, that's been debunked. All this MKUltra stuff, that's been debunked. And I always have to say to them, did you read what he said? Did you read the article? He does not at any point, Brian Dunning does not make a false statement in saying that MKUltra never happened. No, he says we cannot use MKUltra as proof for ongoing mind control programs that continue today. If you read what he said, he didn't disprove MKUltra. And again, it's funny because I think that some people, they're just looking for, honestly, I wonder sometimes, Soraya, truly, if it's this, if people are so terrified by the possibilities and the potentials that a conspiracy element within our society may involve, that they go out looking for someone who quote-unquote disproves these things. They read from these people's perspectives what they want to hear or see, because it makes them more comfortable, and it gives them this kind of a Pollyanna belief system in which, no, none of that stuff's true, and I don't have to worry about aliens and UFOs, I don't have to worry about conspiracies and assassinations and surveillance, because my skeptic guru over here debunked it. You know, I think sometimes it's in a lot of ways, wish fulfillment, and people become denialists because they can't cope with the actual reality that there's some weird junk that goes on out there that even the better skeptical writers, Sharon Hill, Brian Dunning, and others, will advocate and acknowledge.
Well, the thing, you know, with the true believers is that you get people who see conspiracies everywhere, and they back it up based on the assumption of connections.
Yes.
And it's like, oh, well, this person knew this person, and this was connected to this, so this must be what's happening.
Yeah.
Where as soon as you make that jump to this must be what happened, you're making an assumption.
Yeah.
You may have the facts that this person knew that person, but that doesn't mean they conspired. It doesn't mean they knew what was going on. I mean, they might have, but until you have that piece of proof, you can't go any further with it in a rational sort of way. And you get people who do. I mean, if you look at like Lincoln and Kennedy and all the coincidences between there, you know, you've seen that before, right?
Yeah, I have. And frankly, I'll just say this very briefly. I think that when you start seeing all those kinds of bizarre synchronicities, maybe that should be examined, not for the insinuation that, you know, one was a planned attack based on a previous assassination or something like that, but nonetheless, I mean, the synchronicities in themselves seem to point to an aspect of reality that exists apart somewhat from what we perceive as being the day-to-day, if that makes sense. But anyway, that's all I'll say about that.
Yeah, so that's something I've always felt as well. But I mean, when you look at those connections between Kennedy and you know, like the secretary being the same and
yeah.
You know, names and stuff like that, those are all coincidences. There's nothing there that could have possibly been planned or conspiratized, but yet they're there. They're very distinct connections between them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing on a conspiracy level where you look and say, oh, well, look at all these coincidences. But coincidences, synchronicities happen. So you need something more than just that connection to take it a step further.
Yes, I think that the connection is the evidence for a lot of people.
Yes. Know,
whereas I have a friend who's a librarian here in Asheville, and she'll tell you, you know, when you work in reference, and that's your profession, you learn to pay attention to the daily synchronicities because they will happen. And when you put yourself in a position where you're comparing information, you know, I think, again, what we're probably going to begin to find is that Jung somehow stumbled onto that with his psychological and his psychoanalytical research. But I think what we're going to find as we begin to unravel on a purely... I want to actually say a mathematical level, because again, if we're talking about information, I think that a lot of this will entail the utilization of numbers and data. But when we begin to apply more and more computational data to our research into the nature and the fabric of the universe, I think that what we will begin to learn and what we will begin to take back from what we're doing is that there are aspects of reality that we have not up until now, and perhaps, you know, we are yet to fully understand and reveal. I think that there will be aspects of a reality that we will look back on and we will say the synchronicities, the coincidences pointed in that direction, but we could not reconcile with scientifically what they meant at the time. And what I'm specifically getting at, I don't want to sound too vague, I'm specifically inferring something that, again, I think relates to ufology just as well as it does to the general physics of the universe, and that is that I believe we will begin to find out that there is a mathematical and computational component to the fabric of reality, and that the more that we learn about reality, the more we will begin to determine the synthetic, or at very least the aspects that are similar enough to being synthetic. The more we will begin to recognize and understand about reality that appears to be literally synthetic, literally simulated. And I think we will begin to understand that very funnily, or I don't think funnily is a word, but in a very funny fashion we'll say, that what we create with artificial intelligence, with you know, computer rendering, with computer environments, with simulated realities and environments, what we're beginning to understand about computers, it's going to be like a mirror reflected in a mirror, reflected in a mirror, reflected in a mirror, that everything that we perceive as reality, I think, will be, in a sense, found to be simulated. Now, the great question about this, you know, especially in the philosophical sense, is that, well, okay, if aspects of what we perceive as reality are simulations, and synchronicities and strange occurrences maybe are the little pingbacks coming from some sort of a simulated computational logic being applied throughout the universe. If that's the case, then who is in charge of the simulation? Now, it may not be so complex as that there has to be an operator sitting up there playing a computer game that all our lives are being played out in. I mean, that's a woefully anthropomorphized perspective on all this, but again, I think that we'll probably begin to find that what we have begun to look at is human creation, computation, logic, number ordering, mathematics, simulation, these sorts of things. I think we'll begin to find that we're literally, rather than creating and creating order through the creation of symbolism that we utilize for complex computer logic and languages and things like that, I think we'll find that it's actually, in a sense, a simulation in itself, that we are literally copying and mimicking something that is innate to our universe, and that our reality is woven by a very similar fabric, in a sense. I hope that wasn't too bizarre. It's very difficult to term that, but, you know, again, I think that at the very heart of it is that I think that there will be simulated aspects of our reality that we'll come to recognize on down the road, and that synchronicities will kind of point to that once we fully understand aspects of reality that are, you know, rather simulated, I guess.
All right. So what you're saying is that you think that eventually we will find that we're inside a computer program.
You know, again, I think that what we will find is that reality is a lot more like a computer program probably than we realize. I think we're already beginning to see the beginnings of that. I mean, James Sylvester Gates, when I gave my presentation in the UFO Congress in February, and I cited both a philosophical paper that was co-authored by four individuals whose names all slipped my mind right off the top of my head, but James Sylvester Gates Jr., however, is a physicist who's, you know, it's funny, I saw a clip online where he was explaining all this to Neil deGrasse Tyson, and Tyson was just flipping out. It was hilarious. They were on stage, and it was kind of a Q&A type thing, but Gates believes that there are mathematical equations that are representative of what he would call computer coding that he finds innate to the mathematics of supersymmetry and string theory, and that he feels that this points to the fact that the actual dimensional fabric of our universe, again, may bear components that are very similar to what we would recognize as being simulation or, again, yes, maybe a computer program. So, again, without saying that I think that there's somebody who's created a computer program that we're all operating in, and that this is a simulation that is being controlled by someone else, I think that that would have to be the case for reality to bear strong resemblance to the workings of a computer or a simulated program, if that makes sense.
Absolutely, absolutely. All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be back in a minute with Micah Hanks.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
In 2013, mysteries of the past will reshape our future. Paradigm Symposium 2013 in Minneapolis, Minnesota, October 17th through the 20th. Speakers will include Scott Wolter of History Channel's America Unearthed, Egyptologist Robert Bavall, Dr. Robert Schock, and many more. Tickets are available online at ParadigmSymposium.com. Mankind's greatest mysteries brought to the present with new understanding. Visit ParadigmSymposium.com.
All right, and we've been talking to Micah Hanks tonight, and mostly about conspiracies, but we've kind of gone all over the place, really. And we were talking about synchronicities. And I've always kind of felt that synchronicities were sort of a sign that you're on the right path, for lack of a better way of saying it. You know, when you keep seeing something pop up and pop up and pop up, you're going, okay, this is where I'm supposed to be. And I also wonder if it has something to do with the way our consciousness interacts with reality.
I would agree with both of those. You know, again, it's a very difficult thing to try and come to terms with what role we play as what we perceive as being intelligent, sentient, conscious. You know, we're all of these things. Humans are, you know, we are capable of reflecting back on ourselves and thinking about thinking and thinking about why we think and questioning, you know, a lot of things about the way that we function with reality. And yet I think that within that framework, we still are very, 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 very limited in terms of what we're actually able to understand about the interrelationship between what we perceive around us as physical reality and then the thought act and the act of communicating and being in a constant continual feedback loop with the reality around us that we experience on a day-to-day basis. It's very interesting. And so, yeah, again, I think that, you know, when we have things like, you know, Arthur Koestler wrote a book called The Roots of Coincidence, which was a book very much about parapsychological phenomena. But it also, I love the fact that rather than saying the roots of psychic phenomena or the roots of, you know, parapsychology, the book was called The Roots of Coincidence. You know, he seemed to take it back to a more archaic and yet, you know, by the same token, also a more accurate summation of what we're dealing with when we're looking at strange phenomena across the board. Because Koestler, again, often cited as a skeptic, and I brought this up, you know, that his biographer, Michael Scammell, notes that Koestler, of course, actually in the subtitle of the book, Koestler, that he's written, which actually in the German language or Hungarian, you know, to follow his actual line of descent, would have been Koestler, but in the West we call him Koestler, and I think that rolls off the tongue a little better. But Arthur Koestler, again, he was looking at the roots of, in the title, coincidence, and he evokes the singularity premise in his discussion quite a bit. Maybe it is that in terms of understanding, we don't have this full understanding of what our relationship is with reality, and yet we get these little hints about it from time to time that we can either choose to accept and acknowledge or to dismiss and overlook entirely. I personally feel like some coincidences and synchronicities are too good to overlook, and when they get into the realm of being almost intentional, i.e. certain parapsychological phenomenon, for which I think in at least a minute number of cases there seems to be a good potential that there are actually controlled extrasensory abilities that some people exhibit and have done so in the laboratory. I've visited, and as a brief aside, I have to say that I think the most recent episode of Joe Rogan's program, Joe Rogan Questions Everything, he went to the Ryan Institute. I haven't seen it yet, but the morning following Joe Rogan's program, everybody's always emailing me and saying, Micah, what did you think? Micah, what did you think? I don't own a television. I don't know. I'll have to catch it on the replay. But basically everyone's been telling me that by the end of the program, after going to the Ryan Institute and then going and talking to Major Ed Dames, you know, who had been behind the CIA Stargate project and everything in remote viewing, Joe seems to, as typically is the case with this program, he seems to kind of present a more skeptical conclusion about these sorts of things. Now, it's all well and good when you go out there with a bunch of cameras and everything, and you visit the Ryan Institute. Well, I visited the Ryan Institute. I didn't bring cameras because I was told not to. I was allowed to take photographs, but I couldn't record any video or anything like that. And that was just a simple request that my tour guide gave me. Nonetheless, I think there was a bit of a misunderstanding after the fact, because I went on my podcast and talked about my visit, and Sally Ryan Feather, the wonderful gal who is actually the daughter of J.B. Ryan, I think she may have been under the impression I'd literally recorded audio and posted it online, and that wasn't the case. So I emailed her back and everything, and she's such a dear, and we've been in touch a bit ever since. Long story short, having been down there to the Ryan Institute, having been given a personal tour, having been shown some of the inexplicable things that they're even right now researching and studying scientifically, it's a fascinating location. These are fascinating people, but they are scientists. These aren't mystics, these aren't, you know, psychics themselves. These are scientists who are trying to study what Koestler called the roots of coincidence. One day, again, we will begin to find that whether it be those simple coincidences and those synchronicities that occur on a day-to-day basis, or whether it be the actual controlled and apparent intentional ability for some people to utilize extrasensory perception like they study at the Ryan Institute, I think we'll begin to find that these are little hints at the greater nature of reality and the role that we play in conjunction with it. And yes, again, I think that we'll probably ultimately find that there are simulated elements that are a part of all that, but it's going to remain a mystery for us now, and we can only speculate based on, you know, what the likes of James Sylvester Gates Jr. and others have, and even Descartes, going all the way back to the classical philosophers, who began to say, What do we really know about what we know? I think that there's a lot that we still don't know about what we think we know, and yet many in the scientific community. Soraya, I'm sure you've experienced this too. You know, we see Stephen Hawking and people who are downright dismissive toward a lot of things, including UFOs, and I find that that's fairly unjustified in a lot of instances, and it just shows just how close-minded a lot of our scientific institutions and, more importantly, our scientific thinkers and our rock star physicists tend to be at times.
Absolutely. And the thing with Stephen Hawking, too, is that when he came out and said he saw no evidence of God, suddenly it was science proves there's no God.
Oh.
It's like, that's not what he said.
No.
Or was that scientific?
You know, I've taken him to task on a number of things in the past. That's one. But again, I think that's more his perspective. I mean, I've been someone who, on many times on record, you know, I've said I've found no scientific proof of extraterrestrial life visiting Earth. Now, my UFO friends say, what are you talking about? You skeptic, you filthy, dirty, damn skeptic. You know, whereas I'm not trying to take away from what they obviously have begun to accept as a dogmatic kind of belief system. I'm not trying to detract from them or their right to choose to believe in that. I'm merely saying, okay, I've found no evidence. I think that's what Hawking was trying to say about the God thing.
Well, I think it was blown out of proportion by the media, who didn't understand that he was just making a personal statement that, to any degree, is accurate. I mean, we don't have scientific evidence of God, but that doesn't mean that God does or doesn't exist.
That's right. Exactly. And frankly, that if there's something or someone so great and omnipotent as the God that that many of our world religions adhere to, that would be something that, at least in terms of the jurisdictions of our present scientific capabilities, may still exist outside our ability to study. Again, we may come back around to find that, yes, there is a God, and that the God is actually the initiator of the simulation that I've alluded to. And if that's the case, we'll end up finding out that somehow the spiritualists of yesteryear, or yester-epoch for that matter, they had it right on a more intuitive level. And through mysticism and mystical practices, you know, magical practices even, if you will, there may have been people over the ages who have come to this determination that there is something to our nature and to our interrelationship with reality, and that our best ability to try and reconcile with that and maintain that tradition in story form is to create these fantastic woven mythologies, you know, that involve gods, angels, deities, demons, you know, heaven, hell, earth, all these kinds of things. It's more simplistic terminology that employs a lot of things that I think we're finding parallels in modern science. So, you know, but now coming back to Stephen Hawking, despite, you know, the interpretive level of things that he may say that are both accurate and yet by the same token in stark contrast to the beliefs of others, you know, he's also said some things that I've taken serious issue with. Again, he's said, you know, in our, you know, discussion of cosmology and the search for extraterrestrial life, and again, granted, I'm someone who says that I don't think that there's compelling evidence that all UFO phenomenon is representative, if any, for that matter. I don't think that it's necessarily representative of extraterrestrial intelligence. Hawking made a similar statement. I would agree with him, you know, in as much that I share the feeling that maybe UFOs don't represent extraterrestrials. But his justification for that statement was different from mine, and I disagree on that. And this is what he has said. He has said in the past that in our discussion about extraterrestrial life, we can discount discussion of UFOs and UFOs visiting Earth, because if UFOs actually existed, then why would aliens only present themselves to cranks and weirdos? Now, that is such an ignorant statement. Such an ignorant statement. I mean, I could name, you know, granted, a lot of people might say Dennis Kucinich is a crank or a weirdo. I think Kucinich is a very intelligent man. Kucinich, of course, when he was visiting Shirley MacLaine, said that he had seen a UFO. There have been a lot of people who have said over the years that they've seen UFOs, people who I would not consider cranks and weirdos. You know, I've got a new book that's just about to come out called The Ghost Rockets that talks about a number of reports of often rocket-like, but nonetheless very anomalous technologies that have been observed by, you know, again, engineers, scientists, and most often pilots. There have been multiple witness, multiple pilot sightings of a lot of these quote-unquote ghost rockets. And what's really frightening, you know, coming, this brings it full circle and comes back to conspiracies, I guess. Around the time of the TWA Flight 800 crash, there were a number of reports of rocket-like or projectile-like objects that were seen over Long Island Sound. And on one instance, there were actually two planes commercial airliners, passenger jets, that were leaving JFK International Airport. And as they were leaving, they both saw a large, green, rocket-like object streaking through the sky several thousand feet above them. Multiple witnesses on board the actual aircraft, not the passengers, but the actual personnel, observed this craft. They were in constant communication with Boston Air Traffic Control as they were observing this. And again, with my book, I'm not trying to make a case for there being a rocket that took down TWA Flight 81-800, but I point out that there were a number of reports of rocket-like objects and projectiles that pilots were reporting seeing. So that by the general terminology that we employ for the purposes of unidentified flying objects, UFOs, that was a UFO. Some have tried to assert that it was maybe a meteor. But again, the duration that it appeared in the sky, the flight path, which appeared to be very horizontal rather than, you know, taking a diagonal downward approach like most meteorites would do, this and then, of course, the speed at which it was passing through the air, based on the observational data, seems to indicate a craft rather than being some sort of a natural phenomenon. Again, I'm not trying to say that that's what took down TWA Flight 800. It is interesting, A, to note that, yes, there were rocket-like objects seen within the vicinity and in the months and even weeks leading up to and after the crash of TWA Flight 800, but then also that these were very experienced pilots who were seeing these UFOs. And those, to me, are not cranks and weirdos like Stephen Hawking had insinuated. So I just don't think it's fair to make those kind of broad statements. So Hawking's also said that philosophy is dead. With as little as we understand about the nature of reality, really, should we stop with our process of inquiry and say, oh, well, you know, we know everything, and therefore there's no need for the act of logical inquiry, which is what philosophy entails? No, I again disagree very strongly with that. So yes, from time to time, there are people who are very intelligent, men of science, that based on, I think, their own ideological and dogmatic perspectives, they sometimes get things wrong. And I think I think that Hawking has been dead wrong on those two points and many others over the years.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, and I agree. I was also surprised. I was reading the final Odyssey 3001 from Arthur C. Clarke, and he just takes a random pot shot at abductions, like out of nowhere. And I kind of found it surprising coming from Arthur C. Clarke, because I thought he was a little more open-minded to stuff like that. But, looking into the past, he says something like, well, we know there were no other aliens other than the monoliths, and those people were all cranks and delusional and had mental illnesses and stuff like that. And I was like, well, that was a weird pot shot for no particular reason. It didn't support anything that was going on in the story. It's like, why would you do that?
Hmm. Well, I remember on Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World, his television programs, that dealt with the unusual, he would present very compelling information about mysteries, but then he, typically walking up along the beach in Sri Lanka, where he lived, he typically would advocate a more skeptical interpretation of what was being presented on the program, despite the fact that often the program seemed to kind of play up the mystery of what was being discussed. So I think, Clarke was someone who was clearly very interested in unexplained phenomena, maybe even UFOs. He also was an individual who seemed more often than not to kind of downplay their role and their legitimacy. So, maybe that was the scientific side of, because, Carl Sagan was the same way. One of the earliest videos that you'll find online of Sagan is Sagan, probably just freshly graduated from Chicago University, sitting there talking about UFOs. And, one of his very first, may have been his very first television interview. And again, as a cosmologist, who better to talk about UFOs than Carl Sagan? But throughout his career, he seemed to maintain a more skeptical approach to that sort of line of thought. Sure, maybe UFOs are something. No, I don't think UFOs represent extraterrestrial visitation of planet Earth.
Well, I think when we look at the UFO phenomena, we can say with absolute certainty, let's go with certainty,
sure,
since that's the word that wants to come out, that something is going on. These people aren't just making it up. They're not just imagining it. There's enough data to say that something is going on. But to put a specific face on that is almost impossible at this point. We just don't know enough. The data does not make sense to any of the faces we've tried to apply to it. And so it's not something we need to dismiss. It's something we need to look at in a different way, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Like, our concept of reality does not encompass what is happening with that. It doesn't encompass what is happening with other paranormal sort of events. Things seem to be just not fitting in what we think of as normal reality.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think that, again, as we begin to look at and question more deeply reality beyond the fairly limited conceptions of a Cartesian, you know, perspective on reality, when we began to look and we began to understand more and more the nature of the universe, you know, the quantum minutia and the way that the quantum elements of our universe interact with one another, we will begin to find, I do believe, if not answers, more questions. But as those questions come to our attention, we will begin to modify our perspectives toward things that we have in the past called UFO phenomenon, and just in a point-click fashion said, well, they fly through the air, they seem to be technology that exceeds what we know to exist, they must be from outer space, they must be alien. We may look at UFO technologies and say, my God, you know, as we're unraveling the aspects of the universe that have eluded us in the past, and we're understanding this and this and this, these quantities point to something else and perhaps an intelligent control behind certain aspects of it. Could it be that we've been wrong about aspects of the UFO phenomenon all along? Maybe we weren't dealing with alien visitors at all, you know? And maybe we will certainly get to a point, I think, in fact, where we will utilize our understanding of the universe to unravel the mysteries. And we will, again, have to, rather than ask more questions, I think we'll have to restate our initial questions. And it may be that we will come to find that in relation to UFO phenomenon and a variety of other things, that we were asking the wrong questions to begin with based on a fundamental lack of information about the phenomena we were trying to observe.
I think it's also very possible that this phenomena is something poking us, trying to wake us up from this sort of slumber we're still in.
You know, people have criticized Ridley Streber, and it was so funny because when I put out my book, The UFO Singularity, Whitley had me on Dreamland to talk about it, and one of the very first questions was, he says, now, you know, you said, despite whatever you may think about Whitley's credibility, what did you mean by that, Mr. Hanks, when you said that I've never thought of myself as someone whose credibility was questioned? Now, contrary to that, and I pointed this out to him, I said, sure, I think a lot of people have tried to take shots at Whitley Strieber over the years, and so I said, I'm not questioning your credibility in that statement. I'm saying, for those who would, suspend your disbelief, suspend your judgment on Whitley Strieber for a moment, and let's look at some of the things that he has said. He obviously, because he'd actually, and this is what was so neat about it, was that Whitley had actually read my book before he did the interview, and he knew exactly what I was saying, and he, of course, made good radio out of asking that question, maybe somewhat for clarification purposes, but he also knew that from having read the book that, you know, further on into the book, I also, you know, said some very nice things about Whitley, and I said he eloquently words this, and brilliantly so. And what it was that I'd actually pointed out about Whitley was that, again, he is someone who says, in a lot of ways, we're dealing with some phenomenon. He never seems to commit, especially in communion, to, and it's alien, and they're from outer space.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I've always liked about him.
Yeah, he's a really deep thinker and a very interesting person. But, you know, again, Whitley is someone who can acknowledge the phenomenon without having to say, and it was this. And, you know, and I think that, you know, he's looked at everything from potentially time travelers to, you know, to technology that emanate from here on Earth. I mean, he's looked at every different potential. I find that fascinating about him, and that he would do that, and that he would write about things in his book. But my favorite, and this is the one that I wanted to get around to, of all the potentialities that he expressed with regard to his interpretation of even not UFOs, but whatever the phenomena that occurred, the abduction, if you want to call it that, that he experienced. He said, and he merely asked this as a question, and I think it was very fairly stated in questioning it in this way. He said, what if these experiences are what evolution looks like to the human mind as it is being experienced?
I remember that.
It's brilliant. It's one of the most brilliant things that's ever been written in relation to abduction or UFO phenomenon, in my opinion.
Because people who do have these experiences do tend to evolve spiritually.
They do. Absolutely. And even Valet has asked, if there is a control mechanism going on behind the UFO phenomenon, are we being controlled? Are we being manipulated? And is there a technology or an intelligence that's utilizing some means of control for purposes of actually educating and steering our perception in some way or another? What an interesting What an interesting thought. And again, that's, you know, Whitley, you know, summarized that perfectly when he said, you know, if this is what we perceive, but this is actually a byproduct of actual evolution occurring before our eyes, you know, we very well may be controlled to an extent by this intelligence, this technology, this phenomenon, whatever that may be. And again, to me, Soraya, that could point back more to, you know, an element of reality that is synthetic in a sense, that incorporates controls, that incorporates interactions that we may not perceive as being an interaction. And yet it very well may be the case that this is, you know, some sort of a force, some sort of a source of influence that has a very active role in our progression and development as a species, as individuals, spiritually, scientifically, physically, and otherwise. It's, you know, it's fascinating and obviously very complex.
Yes. That's an understatement, I think.
They usually are in this biz, though, aren't they?
Well, I think we're just about out of time, actually, unfortunately. But I want to talk to you real quickly about the Paradigm Symposium you have coming up. Yeah. Now, this is you and Scotty Roberts who are running this, right?
That's right. Yeah, this is the second annual Paradigm Symposium. You know, I'm really looking forward to it because last year, you know, we had Eric Von Daniken. We had a lot of the ancient alien theorists. And I've never really been a huge advocate of ancient alien theory. So people ask me, well, why did you guys, you know, have Von Daniken and people like that at the event? And I said, well, because, you know, I like to promote thought. I like to promote not sham science. I like to promote, you know, a different perspective on looking at the world around us. We had Bob Blaskowitz, who wrote for Skeptical Inquirer, and I actually presented him with a press pass so that he could come and attend the event. There were plenty of skeptics that were in attendance. And again, I think it's good to get conversation going. This year, we're taking it one step further. We're focusing a lot on ancient mysteries, a little less on ancient aliens, but more on ancient mysteries. And we've got speakers like Robert Schock and Dr. Robert Bavall and a few others. But I'll tell you this, and this is what's very interesting. We've also got Scott Walter, who, again, is very open-minded, but nonetheless a skeptical researcher. He's the star of History Channel's America Unearthed. We've got P.Z. Myers. You know, he's a evolutionary biologist, and, of course, he's one of the most outspoken, combative, confrontationalist skeptics out there. He'll be presenting, a thesis against ancient alien theory, because I think, in part, P.Z. maybe perceives that guys like Scotty and I are ancient alien theorists, which is funny. He and I are going to have a lot to talk about when we finally meet at Paradigm. He's probably going to find out we have a lot more in common. But again, the purpose of having such a diverse, you know, cross-section of researchers and people from different areas is with the intention of instilling debate and getting people talking and thinking. That's exactly what we're shooting for. And I sincerely hope that with Paradigm Symposium, maybe even more so than last year, that you're going to people who come to this event, I guarantee you it'll be unlike any event that you've gone to in paranormal circles and the unexplained and ancient mysteries. You will not have been at an event like Paradigm Symposium. And if you attend Paradigm Symposium, you're going to come away with this thinking differently about the phenomena than you had thought previously. And I'm telling you, it's something that will be educational and it will be enriching. And tickets are selling incredibly fast as we're getting in those final weeks, you know, pushing up. It's going to be the week of October the 17th to the 20th. So, you know, definitely I incur people or rather implore people to visit paradigmsymposium.com, take a look at that so that they can find out more about the event.
And that's also linked right on wheredidtheroadgo.com. And what is the price range for tickets to this?
You know, the least expensive tickets are, you know, in the neighborhood of $250. Now, since right now, with it being Labor Day weekend, through Wednesday, September the 4th, we are offering a promotion. This is probably the last time throughout this year that people will have a really significant discount available to them. Right now, tickets are 20% off, but if you buy more than one, they become 30% off, and that's only going to be through September 4th. So we are doing that. Other than if you wait any longer than September 4th, you know, it'll be that standard $250 price. Now, we've got about maybe 12 banquet tickets left, and of course that's a little bit more expensive. That's in the $450 range. But you know, there are three levels of tickets, one that's in between those two that I've mentioned. You know, if you want to be able to come have dinner, sit in on a panel discussion and experience that aspect of the Paradigm Symposium with all our speakers, you know, again, that's a full banquet ticket. But you know, people who just want to come, that $250 ticket, which is again on that promotional discount until September 4th, that ticket is going to get you access to all the speakers, and of course you're going to be able to hang out with people like me and all the other folks who are in attendance. It gets you an awful lot for your buck. So definitely, I advise people check out ParadigmSymposium.com. We got that linked, as you mentioned, on the site, and all the information's right there.
Awesome. All right. And the Grailian Report airs Tuesday.
That's right.
And you do podcast that one. So if people subscribe to your email or whatever, they'll pick it up when you podcast it as well.
Yeah.
Now, the Micah Hanks program does not podcast, does it?
Well, it does, actually. The thing is, however, though, is that since it's with a network, the way that works is KGRARadio.com hosts the podcasts. Now, and this is incredible, it's just $4.99 a month, and it gets you access to all the shows, which are kept in their cachet for about 60 days. So if you want immediate access to those podcasts within that 60-day period, $4.99 a month gets you everything, and they're free to download. But after 60 days, podcasts are also released to the public free for download just as well. So, yeah, the programs will be available on KGRARadio.com.
And that people can listen in on that live as well on Sundays at 9?
It's 8 p.m. Eastern time, yeah.
Okay. All right. Anything else coming up that people should know about before I let you go?
Keep an eye out for this new book I've got, The Ghost Rockets. As a matter of fact, a little bird told me it might already be available online as a Kindle book for purchase through the Amazon Kindle store. So yeah, if you're a Kindle reader, you can already read my latest book, The Ghost Rockets. Otherwise, if you're waiting for it to come out in print, literally we are days away from the launch of that book, and it looks at the very unique history of a very perplexing element of UFO phenomenon. I prefer to call these ghost rockets. I don't think, again, that there's necessarily something alien going on. This is a book that gets a lot into the realm of military conspiracies and history and things like that. But it's a compelling look at a very little studied phenomenon in relation to UFOs.
Yeah, I think John Keel's probably the only other one who's done anything extensive on it.
Yeah, John Keel's written, there's some excellent work that had been done by Jerome Clark, who over the years has written about the ghost rockets. A number of researchers have kind of mentioned what were referred to colloquially as ghost rockets immediately after the Second World War, specifically over the Scandinavian countries.
Yeah.
But there's a lot more to it. And as you'll find out, I believe that there are still ghost rocket reports that occur today.
Nice. All right. And Grailian Report, G-R-Alien.
Report.com
is your website?
That is, and people can also find me online at MicahHanks.com just as well.
All right. Well, I thank you, Micah. Fascinating as always, and people should definitely tune into your podcast because, honestly, I love it. I love listening to it.
Well, that's a good endorsement right there. And I tell you, I have to say, I enjoy your program just as well. I'm going to be catching up on some past episodes that you specifically mentioned to me before we went to air. And listen, I tell you what, let's do this again. I always love coming on with you. The more often, the better, okay?
All right. And some Psyche Corporation to take you out. Last Exit for the Lost is up next.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? Singing soaking into our transmission. 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Whence came this dream that bugs my mind? Behind a curtain, outside of time. Can you hear the ballet plays, the whirring of the world? Can you hear the ballet plays, the whirring of the world? Cypher's ventricles and atria, chambers number 1597, and counting. Can you hear?